Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgebeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello. Dr. Rupert Sheldrake is a biologist and author best known for his hypothesis of morphic resonance. He's worked in developmental biology at Cambridge University, was principal plant physiologist at the International Crops Research Institute for the semi-arid tropics in Hyderabad, India, and was director of the Perrott-Warwick Project for Research on Unexplained Human and Animal Abilities, funded by Trinity College, Cambridge. His world-renowned books include Morphic Resonance, A New Science of Life, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, The Presence of the Past, Seven Experiments That Could Change the World, and The Science Delusion, and many more. Rupert Sheldrake joins me tonight to discuss the themes of religion, atheism, spirituality, rituals, and ceremony covered in his two latest books, Science and Spiritual Practices, Reconnecting Through Direct Experience, and its soon-to-be-published sequel, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, Seven Spiritual Practices in a Scientific Age. Rupert Sheldrake, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. In the preface to Science and Spiritual Practices, you share that you had a fairly conventional Christian upbringing. Your family were Methodists and you went to an Anglican boarding school for boys. But later on, you became an atheist. What prompted you to make that transition?
Well, it just seemed to happen naturally at the time. You know, the message I got from my science teachers was that science and reason are all about progress and the future, and religion's all about superstition and credulity and, and dogma. And, I wanted to be on the side of progress. So it wasn't really a kind of agonizing decision. It was just smoothly going with the flow of the scientific education and the secular worldview.
So over the last 35 years or more, you've been doing experimental research on plant growth, morphic resonance, homing pigeons, dogs that know when their owners are coming home, the sense of being stared at, telephone telepathy, and a range of other subjects. What attracted you to those areas of research, and how have they changed your ideas about religion and atheism?
Well, I began to doubt the mechanistic materialist theory of life when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge. I began to feel that, you know, I loved animals and plants. That's why I did biology. That's why I was studying it. And I noticed the first thing we did was kill whatever we were studying. So I felt something had gone wrong. It wasn't really a science of life. It was a science of, parts of living organisms when they're dead. So I began to think in terms of finding a more holistic alternative. And that was part of my quest. After being an undergraduate, I went to Harvard, where I studied history and philosophy of science to try and get a bigger picture. And I really came to the view by about 10 years after I graduated I was doing research at Cambridge at the time, that biology is not best explained in terms of mechanisms, but there are organizing principles, which I now call morphic fields, and a kind of memory in nature, which I call morphic resonance, which lead to a completely different way of interpreting living organisms. I realized that the mechanistic materialist worldview, which has dominated for so long and still does, excluded whole areas of research from science. They were treated as taboo or beyond the borders of anything you could work on. And it's precisely because they've been so neglected that they're so fascinating. It's like exploring whole new territories. So when I found I could break out of that dogmatic belief system of mechanistic materialism, I found whole new frontiers of science opened up, and some of them I've done research on, which you've just summarized, some of the topics I've worked on. while I was doing that, while I was moving towards a more holistic view in biology, I got more and more interested in the nature of consciousness, partly through psychedelics in the early 1970s, and then through meditation and yoga. And that led me to an interest in Hindu philosophy. I took a job in India, an international institute, doing agricultural research. But that, very surprisingly, the interest in the Indian spirituality, being in India, led me back to a Christian path. And I was actually confirmed in the Church of South India in my 30s. And I then found an extraordinary teacher in India called Father Bede Griffiths, who was an English Benedictine monk living in an ashram in South India on the bank of a sacred river. I wrote my first book, The A New Science of Life, in his ashram. I then went back to work at my agricultural institute, but I took 2 years out to write that book. And that really, for me, was a tremendous expansion of consciousness, reconnecting with the Christian mystical tradition, which I didn't know much about before, and finding a way through Father Bede of integrating Eastern and Western spiritual ideas.
There's been a huge decline, as you point out in your book, in religion in Europe and in North America in recent years. And for many years, there's been a huge divide between organized religion and the so-called New Age spiritual philosophies. But of late, there seems to be more of a coming together, more people who would describe themselves as spiritual but not religious. What do you think is behind this shift?
Well, I think that a lot of people have been put off religion. I mean, the religion that's lost most adherents is Christianity. Most atheists come from Christian backgrounds, some from Jewish backgrounds, but you don't often meet Hindu atheists or Muslim atheists, as it were. And I think part of it is there's been a relentless anti-Christian propaganda within the educational system since the Enlightenment, you know, the end of the 18th century. The French Revolution in 1793 abolished Catholicism in France and proclaimed the cult, the state cult of science and reason. They guillotined thousands of priests. They destroyed the monasteries. It was a very, very strongly anti-Christian movement. The communists in the 19th century were very anti-Christian, and atheism was the official doctrine of communism and of continental socialism. Not so in England with socialists, but on the continent it was. And so atheism became a kind of political movement opposing the power of the church, because in many cases it propped up rather reactionary governments. So it was very politicized. And I think that kind of anti-Christian polemic has now become completely built into the default educational mode of people who go to university or secondary school. It's just part of the air you breathe in an academic environment. And as I did myself, I mean, I didn't very thoughtfully or in an evidence-based way go through these arguments. I just drifted away from the Christian tradition, assuming that proved I was smarter than everyone else. And the general message is that it's not smart to be a Christian or believe in God, whereas it's much smarter not to. So that led to a great prejudice against organized religion. And then, of course, some people had very negative experiences, you know, clerical abuse in the Roman Catholic Church. You know, some people felt they were being brainwashed or indoctrinated. They had intolerant and puritanical upbringings and so on. But the state we've got to in Britain now is that the great majority of people, young people, are brought up with no religion at all. They know very little about any religion. And so it's not as if they're reacting personally against it. They've just absorbed this general prejudice. But there's a spiritual need, I think, in all of us. And I think that the rise of an interest in spiritual practices, yoga and meditation being the most obvious, which came partly through the New Age movement but preceded that, has helped a lot of people to find a spiritual path, but without being part of an organized religion. And so a lot of people I know who say they're spiritual but not religious is really quite a common attitude to have nowadays. I say of myself that I'm spiritual and religious. Some people treat them as if they're opposites, or you can't be one, you've got to be one or the other. I see them as complementary, and some of the spiritual practices, like meditation, are very much about personal development. I think one of the strengths of the religious traditions is that they have a more communal aspect. You know, they bring communities together. You sing with other people. You celebrate festivals together. When I lived in India, it was very striking how the sharing of a religious tradition in Indian villages and towns has a tremendous bonding effect on the population. They're celebrating together in these great festivals, whereas in Europe, you know, many of the great religious festivals, for example, September the 29th, the Feast of St. Michael and All Angels, you know, most people don't even know it's happening. And so there's a loss of that communal aspect in this very individualistic form of spirituality. And I think that reconnecting with religious traditions can help to reconnect us with that communal aspect.
It's a very important aspect. I mean, what we see nowadays is, you know, people might meditate together, but actually they're meditating on their own in the same room as others. Or they may, you know, all be joined by an app and they're doing some meditation, but they're not really connected.
No. And I mean, I think some spiritual practices is perfectly fine to withdraw into the, you know, the one's own consciousness. I myself meditate every morning, so certainly not against meditation. But I also pray, and in my book, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, I discuss the difference between prayer and meditation. I think of it as being, they're complementary to each other. I think meditation, I think of as more like breathing in. You're withdrawing your attention from the world around you, and then when you're meditating, withdrawing your attention from the train of thoughts and worries and ruminations that's going on inside your mind, the internal chatter and dialogue, by having another focus, either the breathing or a mantra. So it's a kind of withdrawal from engagement in daily life and personal worries and so on, to get to the ground of consciousness itself. And that's very important. And it has a very connecting effect with, not with other people necessarily, but with the ground of being. On the other hand, petitionary prayer, asking for things, is the opposite. And you start with making a spiritual connection. All prayers begin with invocations like Our Father who art in heaven, or Hail Mary full of grace, or Om Namah Shivaya, starting with an invocation, invoking a spiritual being, and then connecting that spiritual power with needs, wants, requests. People often pray for healing for themselves or for others, or for protection, or for success in business or exams, or all sorts of everyday and rather mundane things are the focus of much of this petitionary prayer. But what that's doing is connecting the spiritual realm with these concerns. The meditation's withdrawing from them, prayer's connecting with them. So it's a flow in the opposite direction. And I don't see these as either or. I see it as both and. And I myself meditate in the mornings soon after I get up, and I pray in the evenings soon before I go to bed. So I think that prayer is something which can be done more communally. And of course, in all religious services, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Hindu, people are praying together with other people. And so it can have a unifying effect on to pray with others. The other thing that has a very unifying effect through the practice of traditional religion is singing and chanting, because all religions have singing and chanting as part of them. And when you sing and chant with other people, then you literally come into resonance with them. It's a very bonding and connecting experience. And that's why I think singing together is for people in secular societies where they no longer sing every week in church with each other. I think that's why community choirs and other forms of communal singing have become so popular, because they do have this bonding effect. They connect you with other people.
And yet, even as religion seems to be on the decline in the West, it's rising in countries like Africa, which is interesting. And I think we tend to see more community amongst people in countries like Africa, especially those that really are looking for unification.
Oh, yes, we see it. I live in London, and you see it here in London. You know, most English people, recent surveys show, say that they have no religion as the majority of the population. And on Sunday mornings, you know, they'll be cleaning their cars or reading their newspapers or doing social media or something like that. And people go to church, but not many. I mean, I go myself, and I think it's very helpful, and I enjoy doing it, but it's not a mass normal pursuit. But when you look at African and British populations, you know, Nigerians, West Indians, and people from various other parts of Africa, their churches are absolutely packed, and they're full of people singing vigorously, having a wonderfully bonding and communal experience, and they look so happy when they come out. And whereas people have just spent their time on social media and haven't bonded or haven't sung together don't look particularly happy. And you know, and the I don't think it's a coincidence that the prevailing mental disorder in Europe and other so-called advanced parts of the world is depression. Depression, you know, this sense of separation, isolation, pointlessness, disconnection. Lots of scientific studies, which I describe in my books, Science and Spiritual Practices and Ways to Go Beyond, there have now been many, many scientific studies that show that people who have regular religious and spiritual practices are much less prone to depression, also much less prone to drug abuse and other harmful lifestyles.
Indeed. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. My guest today is biologist and author Rupert Sheldrake, who's best known for his hypothesis of morphic resonance. And we're talking about the themes of religion, spirituality, atheism, ritual, ceremony, and more, discussed in his book, Science and Spiritual Practices, Reconnecting Through Direct Experience. We'll be back with more from Rupert Sheldrake after the break.
The future of internet radio is here. Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, you know, your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, Science and Spiritual Practices has been described as a book for anyone who suspects that in the drive towards radical secularism, something valuable has been left behind. In short, the rituals and the ceremonies that not only connect us to each other as families and communities, but also connect us to something bigger than ourselves. We spoke about this a little bit before the break. In what other ways, do we connect, and what other benefits have we lost through the spiritual practices that we don't practice?
Well, I think all traditions you see have, all religious traditions have a whole mixture of spiritual practices, rituals, prayer, singing and chanting, celebrations together through festivals and holy days, pilgrimage, fasting. There's a whole range of these practices which are common to all religions, and you can do them without being part of religion as well. And that's why I wrote this book, really, because it's clear that there's a wide range of spiritual practices. It's also clear that they're common across the world. And it's also clear that the reason so many people do them, the reason they're traditionally adopted, is that they work. They have measurable effects on brains, physiology, people's well-being, a sense of community, and so on. And there have now been a lot of scientific studies that show that's the case. So that's the whole point of my books, is to show how the scientific evidence points to their effectiveness, personal experience points to their effectiveness, and in each of the chapters I suggest ways in which people can do these things themselves. I would say one of the simplest of them all is gratitude, and there's now a lot of research by positive psychologists who look into what makes people happy, that suggests that people who are grateful are much happier than people who are not grateful. And if you do gratefulness exercises, then you get happier. I mean, quite simple things like just making a list of things, good things that have happened in the previous week, or people to whom you feel grateful who have helped you, actually makes people feel happier. It also makes them more popular, because this research has shown something that's not really very surprising. It's that people who are grateful and who appreciate what's going on around them and what people do for them are more popular than people who take everything for granted and instead of being grateful, complain. They're less popular, they're less fun to be with. It's obvious, really, but you know, now there's a scientific evidence that this is the case. So gratitude, again, coming back to the theme we were talking about earlier, it can be done individually. One can make a list mentally or writing it down, or it can be done together. And one of the things I suggest in my chapter on gratitude in science and spiritual practices is simply restoring what used to be a standard practice in many families. Certainly when I was growing up, it was quite common. The families before meals would sit down together and share a grace. Someone would say a grace, or they'd say a grace together. So there was a way that everyone came together in giving thanks. It still happens in traditional institutions. In my Cambridge College, Clare College, when I dine there on High Table, which I do several times a year, at 7:30, at the beginning of dinner, the gong goes, everyone stands up, and then there's a long Latin grace. Most people probably don't know what it means, but the fact is it creates a kind of break, a pause before eating, in which there's a space to give thanks, and it's giving thanks together. And I think that many families could restore that practice if they don't already have it. In my own family, we always hold hands together before we eat a meal, sometimes in silence, sometimes someone says a grace. When there are more of us at gatherings, we usually sing a grace as a kind of round. And the atmosphere changes completely before the meal. Suddenly everyone's brought together, there's a sense of joy and there's a sense of connection. It takes, you know, less than a minute. And the alternative, the normal thing in secular modern Britain, is that there's a kind of awkward pause before the meal, and then someone says, oh, do start, it'll get cold, or something like that. By having a way of bringing people together and doing it silently, it means that there's no one's going to object. I mean, even atheists don't object to a little bit of silence before a meal, a chance to collect one's thoughts. There's no reason why atheists or secular humanists should object to giving thanks, because even if you don't believe in God, there's a lot to be thankful for. The people who prepare our food, grow it, the sun that enables the plants to produce our crops, and so on. Plenty to be thankful for, even if one doesn't believe in God. So I think that these simple practices like this can actually have a transformative effect on people's lives. And in other words, I think that people who don't do these things are really missing out.
Well, the other thing too is that, I mean, the hypothesis of morphic resonance, you know, illuminates what we're tapping into when we do engage in ceremony or ritual or chanting, singing. I mean, there's this whole field that we're stepping into, which is rich and historic. And, you know, that must be beneficial on many levels that we cannot see.
I think so, yes. I think morphic resonance is the idea that it's a hypothesis that there's a memory in nature, and it's based on similarity. In its most general sense, it says that the so-called laws of nature are more like habits. Also, that each species has a kind of collective memory. This is rather like Jung's idea of the collective unconscious. But where it affects rituals, as you suggest, is that through morphic resonance happens on the basis of similarity. The more similar patterns of activity are, the more they resonate across space and time with those who've done them beforehand. And the whole point of rituals is that people do things in a similar way to the way it's been done before. For example, the American Thanksgiving dinner is a national ritual. The rituals don't have to be religious. They can be secular or national as well. And it involves coming together. It involves having a meal together. It involves giving thanks. It involves a particular kind of meal. It's a reenacting, in a way, of the first Thanksgiving dinner of the first settlers in the New World around 1620. And by taking part in it, Americans connect with other people they're sharing the ritual with, family and friends. And they also connect with all those who've done it before, right back to the first time. And the same thing happens with the Jewish Passover ritual or the Christian Holy Communion itself, originally a Passover dinner. And people who take part in these rituals connect with other people who are doing them at the same time, connecting with other co-celebrators or participants, but also through morphic resonance, linking to all those who've done it before across the generations and linking to all those who will do it in the future. So these rituals are about connection. They're about connection with other people who are taking part in the same ritual and also connecting with those who've done it in past generations, with the ancestors and those who've come before, and with those who follow. And that, I think, is why rituals are so important and so powerful, because this sense of connection is something we all need. Happiness is very much to do with feeling connected, being in the flow, and being connected to a kind of flow. And rituals connect us with the flow through the generations, the flow of the community that we're part of. Whereas unhappiness is about being disconnected, separated, alienated, yes. Lonely. And so I think that's the reason that rituals are so important. And I think that's why they play such an important role in every single culture in the world.
And one of the other, you offer seven spiritual practices in science and spiritual practices. And one of the other ones, which I particularly enjoyed, is pilgrimage. And I love the story about how you have created a little ritual with your godson when you go on a small pilgrimage. Would you share that with us?
Yes. Well, I have several godchildren, and one of them is a teenage godson. And when he was 14, several years ago, I was trying to think what to give him for his birthday, and I stopped giving people stuff because most people have got too much stuff. I give experiences. And I said to him, well, look, what my offer is this. For your birthday present, I'll take you on a pilgrimage to Canterbury. We'll go to Canterbury Cathedral, which was this great site of pilgrimage in the Middle Ages, as in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. We take the train to a village about 8 miles from Canterbury. We walk the last 8 miles through fields and meadows and orchards. We visit a healing well, the Black Prince's Well, a medieval healing well. We go to the cathedral. We light candles at the shrine of St. Thomas. We have tea and then go to choral evensong, which is this beautiful sung service that happens in all our English cathedrals every day, more or less. So I said to him, is that something you'd like to do? And without hesitation, he said yes, and we did that. We had a wonderful day, really wonderful. That was when he was 14. When he was 15, we went to Ely Cathedral, 16, Lincoln, 17, Wells, 18, Winchester. And this year, he's 19. We're going to Chichester. In each case, we have the same general pattern. We walk. The pilgrimage on foot is very important. It connects you with nature. You're walking through the countryside. You go to a holy place, a place which is a link between heaven and earth that connects the two. You go with an intention or a goal, and it makes it very different from just going for a stroll in the country or a hike. It has that as part of it, of course, and it's sort of healthy in itself to be outdoors and walking. It also has a kind of bonding effect, doing something together like this.
Yes.
I think a lot of, in America, the most obvious pilgrim destinations in the countryside are what I think of as sacred groves, the national parks, these great places of natural beauty. But American cities also have some great cathedrals. New York City has two fabulous cathedrals, St. Patrick's and St. John the Divine, the Episcopal Cathedral. And, you know, I've been on pilgrimage walks in New York as well. I think it's, you know, it's perfectly possible to do this in a city. And actually, it works so well with my own godson, and now a few other people I know have done it with their godchildren. I think it's something that a lot of godparents could consider. I mean, godparents, on the whole, are chronically underemployed. And I think this is a really good way of doing something about being a godparent with one's godchild.
I so agree. Ever since my own grandchildren have been small, I've had what we call adventure days, and they've become a bit of a ritual. But, you know, as they're getting older now, my eldest grandson is 14, I really would like to take him on the Camino with me.
That would be a fabulous thing to do. I mean, you couldn't do it all, probably, unless you... But lots of the Camino to Santiago is... A lot of people do bits of it, and you can do bits and then go back and do another bit another year. And one of the things that's happening in Britain is the old footpath pilgrimage routes are being reopened. And one of the ones that's being reopened is the old way to Canterbury. It's about 18 days from Winchester or Southampton. Again, if you ever do a pilgrimage in Britain, there's now a website from the British Pilgrimage Trust called britishpilgrimage.org, which has dozens of wonderful pilgrimage routes in Britain, some of them one-day routes, some of them 3 or 4 days, and some up to 3 weeks. So this resurgence of pilgrimage is going on all over Europe. You know, it was inspired partly by the Camino to Santiago to Compostela in Spain. But there's now a resurgence of pilgrimage even in countries like Ireland, where it never stopped, but it's being restarted, but with a greater emphasis on walking there rather than driving there or taking a bus or a train. And so this is a particularly interesting thing. Although Europe's become so irreligious, pilgrimage is very much on the increase at the moment.
You say that pilgrimage has the great advantage of being both a practice and a metaphor. Tell us about the metaphor part.
Well, pilgrimage is a journey to a goal, a holy place. You know, and all religions have them. Muslims go to Mecca, Hindus go to temples or to the sacred river Ganges, and Jews go to Jerusalem. And there are many focuses of pilgrimage, but they all have this quality of going on a journey, which is a literal, physical expression of a spiritual quest. You're going to connect with a place of spiritual power that links heaven and earth. It's a place where people have been transformed before, where there's been opening up of the dimensions to the spiritual dimension. So it's a physical journey. It's also a metaphor, because one can see the whole of life as a pilgrimage with a spiritual goal. And in fact, that's what happened in that very famous book of 17th yes. century English literature, The Pilgrim's Progress, by mm-hmm. John Bunyan. It takes the idea of a pilgrimage and makes it into a metaphor for our whole journey through life. So I think that the metaphor of pilgrimage is a very good one for life, but it doesn't really work so well as a metaphor unless you've actually done a pilgrimage. Otherwise, it's just an idea.
Yes.
But if you've actually done a pilgrimage or done several, then you actually... It means much more. It fleshes out this metaphor. It makes it a living experience.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and tonight I'm speaking with biologist and author Dr. Rupert Sheldrake about the themes covered in his two newest books, Science and Spiritual Practices, Reconnecting Through Direct Experience, and the soon-to-be-published sequel, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, Seven Spiritual Practices in a Scientific Age. We'll be back with more from Rupert Sheldrake after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Lisa Barry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Rupert Sheldrake, in your forthcoming book, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, Seven Spiritual Practices in a Scientific Age, you combine the latest scientific research with your extensive knowledge of mystical traditions to show how we may tune into more than human realms of consciousness. Can you give us a brief overview of the seven spiritual practices you're writing about in that book?
Yes. The first one I write about in the book is on sports. And for most people, that's a surprise, because in our secular world, most people don't think of sports as a spiritual practice. But actually, I think they're the principal way in which most people in the modern world do actually enter altered states of consciousness, have a sense of connection and presence that they don't get through sort of the more mundane parts of their life. One of the things about spiritual practices is coming into the present, and in meditation, that's one of the important things, is to come into the present through the mantra or the breathing and rather than being taken away from it all the time by ruminations, thoughts, worries, etc. Now, if you're skiing downhill at 60 miles an hour and there's a cliff on one side that you could easily go over, or if you're in the middle of a football game and people are coming to you to tackle you to get the ball, or if you're driving a racing motor bicycle very fast, you have to be in the present. Or on a mountain, or on a rock face, if you're a mountaineer, you have to be in the present, because otherwise you're dead, or at least going to have a serious accident. And so one thing sports does is brings people into the present, into a state of flow. And many people actually have mystical experiences through sports. One of the first people to point this out was Michael Murphy, who was a founder of the Esalen Institute in 1962. He's a very keen sportsman, a keen golfer, and he wrote a famous book called Golf in the Kingdom about the mystical side of golf, which has been a bestseller among golfers for years, because it brings out this mystical side of golf. It's not just about winning or testosterone or hitting small balls around the golf course. There's a lot more to it than that, and so there is to other sports. So anyway, I have a whole chapter on the spiritual dimension of sports. Then I have a chapter on learning from animals. Again, many people find that surprising, because animals are normally considered not part of the spiritual realm, but any spiritual view of nature, I think, has to include the fact that all creation is a reflection of the divine, that in all animals there's something of the divine. And we can see it in lots of ways, from their beauty. Some animals are very beautiful in the way they move and the way they look. Many of them non-human animals don't have the problem we have of worries and inner chatter, internal dialogue. They don't have language, so they don't have internal dialogues. That means they're much more in the present. And one of the aims of spiritual practices is to come into the present. Animals don't have to work at it, and that's their natural condition, which is why I think we can learn from them. When they're in the present. For example, if you've got a cat sitting on your lap purring, the cat's completely in the present, is expressing its pleasure and joy, really, at being in the present. And, you know, one way is to just stroke it distractedly while thinking or something else. Another way is to just enter into that sense of presence with the cat. It can actually help you come into a sense of presence and connection, which is a kind of spiritual practice, as coming into the present. And I myself think that animals may also have kind of mystical type experiences. I think it's very arrogant of us humans to think we're the only ones with a hotline to God. I think animals have many of the features we experience as spiritual. I mean, they live in the present. They often show altruistic behavior. I mean, even insects like worker ants or worker bees, they're not in it for the money. They're not in it for themselves. They're in it for the good of the greater community, far more so than most humans. And dogs are famous for their loyalty and the unconditional love they show us. Well, among humans, that level of unconditional love is found in saintly people, but most people, I think, fall short of the level shown by the average dog. And I think it's quite possible that when a lizard is basking in the sun, or when a songbird is singing its beautiful song, it has a sense of connection to something much greater than itself, and beauty and the sun and the wider universe. And so I think we can learn from animals about spirituality. And then I talk about fasting, because fasting is a spiritual practice in all traditions. Jewish people fast at Yom Kippur, Muslims in Ramadan, Christians in Lent, Hindus have various fasting days. Shamanic cultures often have fasts before ceremonies or rites of initiation, or do them during vision quests, and so on. And the physiology of fasting is that you go into ketosis, the body breaks down stored fats. Ketone bodies in the blood, acetoacetic acid, beta-hydroxybutyric acid, and acetone, actually affect the level of neurotransmitters in the brain. Beta-hydroxybutyric acid is psychoactive in the sense it changes the levels of neurotransmitters, leading to altered states of consciousness. And people, when they're fasting, often feel their minds are clearer. They can pray and meditate better, concentrate better. And of course, it's known to have enormous health benefits to fast. That is for people who are in reasonable condition to start with. Obviously, not recommended for anorexics or for people on vast numbers of pills that the whole fasting might disrupt, or in difficult medical situations. But for most people, fasting is tremendously good for them, both spiritually and physically. And I myself do it every year during Lent for at least 4 days, usually just before Easter, and find it a really helpful practice. So that's fasting.
You also write about cannabis and psychedelics.
Yes, I also write about cannabis and psychedelics, and again, that's probably for some people surprising, even shocking, and perhaps unexpected. But the reason I do that is partly because, for me, in my own lifetime, both cannabis and psychedelics have been helpful spiritually. They've opened. I've had kind of spiritual openings. This particularly in the 1970s, when I was in my kind of atheistic, rather narrow scientific phase. I first took LSD in about 1970. I would have been, 28 or something. And the effect was extraordinary. I mean, it gave me the sense of a vastly greater realm of consciousness that no one had ever told me about before, that I'd never thought of before. The same thing happened when I first took cannabis, which I did in India with a holy man in the Himalayas. It was the first time I ever experienced it, and it was a kind of spiritual, mystical experience for me. And psychedelics have been used in shamanic cultures and in religious practices for a long time. And there are now psychedelic churches. The Santo Daime Church in Brazil is a psychedelic Christian church where people take ayahuasca as a kind of communion in services. Certainly there are a lot of people who do feel that these things have a spiritual value. And for many young people in our society, where we no longer have powerful rites of passage, I think psychedelics for many people serve as a kind of rite of passage, as they did for me. And I think it's better to acknowledge that and recognize that this can be a spiritual opening than to pretend that it's meaningless, valueless, and so on, because people who've had these experiences don't find them meaningless or valueless or illusory. They often feel that they're having openings and that they're helpful. Of course, cannabis and psychedelics can be dangerous, particularly for people prone to psychosis, and I'm certainly not advocating the indiscriminate use of illegal substances. But I think the situation in the United States and in Canada is now a very interesting one, because cannabis is now legal in many states. And and some, like Colorado, have decriminalized the use of psilocybin, magic mushrooms. Mm-hmm. So now it's possible to do these things without the stigma of illegality. And I think that churches and synagogues and other religious organizations are going to have to come to terms with this. They could just say no when it was illegal. But as a matter of fact, there are now Jewish groups in the United States, in states where cannabis is legal, who've introduced taking cannabis into their Havdalah ceremonies, which are at the end of the Sabbath, a communal meal at the end of the Sabbath on Friday, Saturday evening, where traditionally they drink wine and they have sweet spices, but some now have cannabis-infused bagels, and they find that it brings the communal spirit, the celebration, the togetherness of the group of friends. It makes it more powerful and really helps. And when I was doing research for my book, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, I looked online to see what was happening in American states where cannabis is now legal among sort of evangelical Christians. And I was not totally surprised to find that in Colorado, for example, there are now cannabis-fueled Bible study groups where people are meeting together to study the Bible and taking cannabis together, and people saying how much more effective this was and how this was the kind of Jesus they were experiencing, they'd always wanted to know, and so on. So here in Britain, there's a sort of an underground movement, because cannabis is illegal here, called Cathedrals on Cannabis, where people take cannabis before visiting these great medieval cathedrals we have here in Britain, or Renaissance or cathedrals, and find that their whole experience is transformed. They have an extraordinary sense of divine presence, which they might not have had so intensely without the cannabis. So I'm sure that these drugs can play an important spiritual role, although it's also clear that they have their dangers and have to be done in an appropriate way by people who are old enough to know what they're doing.
For sure, yes. Prayer, of course, is another one of your chapters, and we all know there's enough studies been done on the power of prayer to know that there is something quite phenomenal happening when we engage in prayer.
Yes, yes, and there are studies that show now that people who pray are much happier, healthier, and live longer than those that don't. In a study in America, they took about 2,000 people aged 65, and one half of the group prayed regularly, the other half didn't. And they were matched for age, health level, income level, and that kind of thing, and social status, and all that. 6 years later, the people who prayed had survived 65% better. I mean, the number that had died was 65% less than among those that didn't pray. So it actually has measurable effects on longevity, and generally speaking, people who pray regularly are much less prone to depression than those who don't. So prayer certainly benefits the people who do the praying. It doesn't always work in the sense that not all prayers for people's healing work. I mean, if they did, no one would ever die, because most people who are in bad ways get prayed for, and yet we die. But by the same token, the modern medical system isn't 100% successful either, for the same reason that if it was 100% successful, no one would ever die, and clearly we do die. So my point really is that prayer can help people in all sorts of ways, including in healing. There's many examples of prayer leading to successful healing, not necessarily miraculous healings, but helping people get better with normal medical treatment. It's not either or, it's both and. And so it can have many benefits.
Indeed. I know that you're pushed for time tonight. I just want to end with something. In 2017, I interviewed a leading commentator on religion, politics and culture called Diana Butler Bass, who wrote a book called Grounded, finding God in the world, in which she argued that religion isn't dying, there's just a major transformation occurring in how people understand and experience God. And in her research, more people were turning to nature and the land. And a reviewer wrote something about that book that really stuck with me over the past few years. What they said was that it was an invitation to allow our experience to inform our theology rather than allow our theology to dictate our experience. And that review, that comment was with me throughout the reading of your book. It certainly felt to me as though your book is an invitation to cultivate the seven spiritual practices and more, which will allow us, you know, allow our experiences to inform our theology.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that it worked in that way for you, Sandy, because that really is one of my intentions. We start, spiritual practices lead to experience, and it's experience that is the key thing. And in fact, it's experience that underlies all religions originally. The Buddha didn't get enlightened by doing a PhD.
Exactly. Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, we were out of time. I know you have to go. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
A pleasure talking with you, Sandy.
You too. Bye-bye. Science and Spiritual Practices and the soon-to-be-published Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work are published by Coronet Books. You can learn more about Rupert Sheldrake's work, books and events at sheldrake.org. And you can read an edited transcript of this interview in next week's edition of Om Times magazine, which features Rupert Sheldrake on the cover. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today. I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.